This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Fast food workers across the Triangle went on a digital strike last Friday. Participants demanded better sanitary supplies and paid sick leave. The local strike follows a wave of national labor organizing in all parts of the food system, most notably at Amazon and Whole Foods. At the same time, Amazon is looking to hire 100,000 more warehouse and delivery workers across the country. WUNC reporter Jason DeBruin joins me now. Hello, Jason.
Frank, hi. Good to be with you.
Talk about the demands now for striking Triangle fast food workers. Were they met?
Largely no. Some of them were. We should say that there were some more sanitary supplies, and I think that there were maybe some more protections in place for workers who, want to protect themselves from the coronavirus. But in terms of, paid sick leave or certainly $15 an hour, no, those were not met, certainly not overnight.
All right. And any sense that this, the organizing continues and where the movement is at the moment?
Well, it does continue. This was organized by the group Fight for 15. You've had them on your show before. They've been active for years. So that sort of broader fight is ongoing. I think the paid sick leave is probably going to become a bigger tenet probably in some of their demands. But that push has been going on for a while, and I imagine it will go on for some time even after COVID-19 passes.
Well, workers made the argument that their demands were in the customer's best interest, and certainly protective equipment is easy to see, but there's another demand for paid sick leave. Talk about how that fits into this.
Well, exactly. And this would apply, to coronavirus, but certainly, any other respiratory disease, even the flu as well. You can just imagine that if somebody's, preparing your burger and has the flu, it's not sort of difficult to understand how that flu might be transferred to you whenever you get that burger. But people are paid so little and don't have enough hours and don't have that paid sick leave that they feel pressure to come into work just in order to, make sure that they can pay rent at the end of the month. They literally can't miss a shift. And so without paid sick leave, when they're sick, they come to work, then they're carrying the flu or, even the coronavirus when they're at work. And then that obviously could potentially put the customer in danger as well.
Now, this week, the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union successfully negotiated with Kroger for temporary increases in pay, benefits, and protections. 460,000 unionized grocery workers across the country. It includes those at the Harris Teeter. So are there indications that grocery employees could advocate for permanent pay increases and benefits?
Well, they could certainly advocate for it. We'll see what happens. Some economists are a little bit dubious that, this will continue after we, in the next year or so. It's certainly possible. I think, grocery store employees are making a pretty valid case that they're essential, right? I mean, it's very important for people to get their food no matter what is going on around them. And so, they can certainly advocate for themselves maybe a little bit more strongly. But again, it will remain to be seen how successful that advocacy can actually be.
Well, it's interesting. Let's talk about the paradox of bargaining leverage in this moment. We're in a crisis, and we all know what the need is. We all know what the dangers are. But then let's take a look at what else is happening in the economy. Groups of workers at Amazon, Whole Foods, and Instacart also protesting work conditions, many of them classified as essential workers. But does that really give them extra leverage in this time of record high unemployment?
So the answer is it does, but only to a certain extent. You mentioned the people being hired at Amazon, but at the same time, again, we learned today of some 6 million people applying for unemployment insurance, and that comes on the 3 million people that did so just a week ago. And I mean, these are orders of magnitude greater than the Great Recession. It's almost incomprehensible how many people have been laid off, right? And so the workers at Amazon can advocate for themselves only insofar as there's not another worker behind them who's willing to do the work for what Amazon is offering. And I pick Amazon, that applies to any company, of course. So, certainly you could hope that when coronavirus passes, that we can hopefully turn the switch on to the economy and get things moving quickly again. We've heard of that, V-shaped recession where it rebounds pretty quickly. But if it does not happen and we have more of that U-shape or even that Nike swoosh-shape recovery, then we would see what happened after the Great Recession, which was where workers had a very difficult time advocating for themselves because there was still that high unemployment, and workers were, you know, willing to hold on to a job, even if that meant that there weren't great working conditions.
Well, and I would guess technology is the other unknown factor. Clearly, high tech and technology are part of the answer to how you deal with fewer and fewer humans coming into contact and still conducting business. And, you know, more automation and more technology has, you know, historically meant fewer and fewer jobs. So we could look at possibly something like that affecting labor leverage going forward after this is over.
Totally. And that would apply, you know, you mentioned Amazon, that could strongly apply there, right? As robots take over warehousing. So robots are taking over warehousing. People after this, one of the big sea changes might be that people order more groceries online. And so instead of having people stock the shelves at your local grocery store every night, you have a robot stocking the warehouses of an Amazon. At Amazon. Now, clearly grocery stores aren't just simply going to go away, right? But to your point, that's one of the ways that technology could potentially hurt employees if people start to order more food online.
All right. Jason DeBruin, a reporter at WUNC. Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.
Well, food service employees are being asked to step up and keep working despite the risks. The rest of us are just trying to get a handle on what those risks are when it comes to groceries, meal kits, takeout delivery. It's all very confusing. And joining me now with some answers is Natalie Seymour. She's a food safety extension associate with North Carolina State University. Welcome, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
It's good to have you here. Let's just start with some basics. I mean, people are very concerned about, you know, everybody wants fresh produce. Mm-hmm. The grocery stores are open, but that stuff is out there. I look at a head of lettuce, don't like it, put it back. What should I do with groceries, and can I trust taking them home and eating them?
Yeah, that's a great question, and a lot of people are asking the same thing. And what we know now is that there is no significant link to food or food packaging and virus transmission. So in the almost million cases that we've had worldwide, food is not even making the list as potential ways that people are getting this virus. What we know is that you're getting this virus if you're in a situation where you're around a lot of people and you're having a lot of common high-touch surfaces. So grocery shopping needs to look a little different, but for the purposes of staying away from large groups of people and trying not to touch high-touch surfaces. So like you just mentioned, you look at a head of lettuce and maybe pick something else. Maybe you're doing a lot of that inspection more visually instead of picking that up.
Yeah, and I'm not... keep going. Please keep going.
So one of the things that we've been talking about a lot is trying to maintain social distancing and more or less keeping your hands to yourself when you're in the grocery store. So I've even taken to holding onto the cart handle while I'm looking at stuff, so I'm not tempted to touch an item that I'm not going to purchase. We're looking at things like going in with a game plan. I know plenty of people who love to just walk up and down the grocery store aisles just to see what's there. But this isn't really the time for that. So going in, knowing what you want. Go ahead.
And just kind of shop with your eyes is the to the best that you can. And you talked about high touch, so we're concerned a little bit about the shopping bag itself. That doesn't seem to be the same as railings, handrails, counters, shelves, that sort of thing. Is there a significant difference, would you say? How worried do I have to be about the bag?
The bag would not be something that we consider something to be really worried about because those are brought in, put on the bag holders, and then used, maybe touched once by the cashier and then once by you. When we're talking high touch services, grocery cart handles, the basket handles, card readers, stuff like that. So using hand sanitizer before you go into the store is a good idea, just in case you have something on your hands. Bringing a disinfectant wipe to wipe down that cart handle, to wipe down the card reader before you use it. A lot of these grocery stores are providing that already. So if they haven't, take advantage of it. But those high touch surfaces we're thinking about, you know, conveyor belts, don't lean up against the conveyor belt, big display, stuff like that. But the grocery bags themselves, not really something we consider super high touch.
So far we've talked mostly about my behavior as a shopper to protect others, keep my hands to myself. But if I take home a package that may have been picked up several times, I mean, is there anything I should do about that? Put it, you know, quarantine that for several hours or anything like that, or would that not be necessary?
right now we don't have enough evidence to say that touching a package that was touched by someone who had the virus is going to be significant to you getting COVID-19. What is still going to be a concern is basic food safety practices. So we want to make sure that we're still handling food safely, and that means refrigerating food that needs to be kept cold, making sure things are stored in a way that prevents them from being contaminated. It is a good idea to wash your hands when you get back from the store. Definitely a good idea once you put up those groceries to wash your hands again, because if you're going to get COVID-19 from any sort of surface, it's not that the surface itself got you sick. It's that you touched that surface and then touched your face or your nose, or your eyes or something like that.
Right.
So hand washing, we've all gotten really good at washing our hands. Just keep doing that even when you bring your groceries home.
And to give us more insight into our behavior as buyers, we're joined by Stacy Wood. She is Langdon Distinguished University Chair of Marketing at NC State's Poole College of Management. Hello, Stacy.
Hello.
Stacy, let me start with you and ask you this question about shortages, because we've heard about them. We've seen the pictures at our grocery store and caused, of course, by our own behavior as consumers. What determines how consumers respond to something like this?
Well, there's lots to say that perceived scarcity impacts us in different ways. So one thing to remember here is that there's not going to be one typical response of the entire population. Variable that strikes me right now is this idea of approach versus avoidance motivation. So this is the idea that there's a big crisis, there's an issue, and in order to regain some sense of control over people in my life, some people are going to go for an approach motivation where they're really going to go into problem-solving mode. And at extreme levels, that might be stocking up on, you know, toilet paper. On the other hand, there are going to be people who try to reassert control by avoiding the issue. And so these are the people who are going to be almost militantly for a business as usual mindset, where they refuse to do the social distancing that we heard about earlier.
Well, Stacy, you're breaking up just a little bit. We're gonna see if we can improve your connection and come back to you. Natalie is still with us, so stay with us, and we're gonna try to make reconnection in the back room while Natalie and I continue this conversation. You know, Natalie, we were talking about food safety, and I know you said food is safe, and we talked about the vegetables and all that sort of thing. But let's just really focus on this and kind of reiterate what you said, which is like the vegetables are safe, right? Even if they're in the produce department and open. We just have to wash them, which I assume most people normally do anyway. Is there something more that we have to do now than the way we're already washing our fresh vegetables?
No. Right now, the recommendation stays the same, that you wash your fruits and vegetables with cold running water. We are not recommending the use of dish soap or bleach or any sort of things like that. Like we talked about earlier, we don't have any significant connection right now with this virus being transmitted through food. What we do know pretty certainly is that people do get sick from consuming things like dish soap and bleach. And so the recommendation is still to wash your produce, using cold running water. You can use your hands to kind of rub on that apple or something like that to continue to wash that. But the recommendation for handling produce hasn't changed.
All right. Well, Stacy Wood is back with us now. She is a marketing professor at North Carolina State in the Poole College of Management. Stacy, you were talking about sort of why we do these things. And maybe I'll just have you go over it, because I think we lost a fair amount of what you were saying about this business of to some extent, wanting to take control. So there's a percentage of us that feel like we got to do something. And one of the things we can do is buy up a lot. And then you were talking about people who are avoiding it, saying, nothing's happening. Watch this. I'm going to go in like business as usual.
That's right. And it is a function of a continuum we talk about a lot in marketing, approach avoidance. So approach versus avoidance, whether you go at an issue and address it, pay attention to it, or whether you avoid it. And so when you think of that continuum from the people who are regaining control, regaining a sense of control through their purchases, some people are going to really approach the problem, really try and problem solve, buy up, lots and lots of toilet paper, make sure they've got, lots of beans and rice. And then people who are going to do the opposite, where they're going to almost be fanatical about maintaining business as usual. And that's a continuum, like, right, a normal distribution. So we might have people who are doing the very extreme versions of that, who are relatively small segments of the population. And everyone else's, the most common response is going to be somewhere in the middle.
And I think, and what about over time? Because this thing is really dragging on, and it's going to be with us for some time to come. As for your designated shopper, as they get to the store more and more frequently, or more often over time, and notice, okay, things are still there. Do people begin to relax if an episode like this lasts long enough?
Well, I think people might, let's say they're in that strong approach mentality where they really want to pay attention and be a problem solver. They may stop stocking up on things that don't seem that scarce. Perceived scarcity does impact us. And so scarce goods seem more attractive to us. So when they say, okay, this isn't really as scarce as I thought, they may turn their minds to a different kind of mechanism. They might be more consumers of news stories and pay more attention and or try and grow gardens or, you know, do other things to protect themselves.
That's interesting. So if you don't get
it from that, it's going to be a different strategy, but it's still going to be an approach strategy.
Well, that's interesting, because what you're suggesting then is if there is this control mentality and you don't relax that at some point, you'll simply transfer that, which is going to mean you'll maintain your stress and anxiety levels at the highest, at more or less the peak, and simply transfer the items or the objects of your control.
Yeah, and the neat thing about it is that we have these different consumer behaviors that in stress actually help relieve stress. It actually relieves stress for people to buy up lots of toilet paper or to start a garden or whatever is in that sense of I'm approaching this problem proactively and I'm doing something. And it also relieves stress to be on the other side for people who have an avoidant mentality to say, look, I am going to not read the news. I am going to not change my behaviors. I am going to do the same things. And that's going to let me feel like this isn't really there.
I wonder if that's I wonder if there's a short run, long run, a question in this, which is that it does relieve stress in the short run. But as you notice, mm-hmm. it hasn't really changed the situation out there.
Right.
Do you then begin to sort of obsess and almost, sort of have a neurotic connection, attachment to these things that simply aren't solving your problem?
Maybe. And I think that, again, there are lots of ways in which we're trying to have healthy responses to the unusual situations. One of the research projects I did a while ago, in fact, I may have even talked to you years ago about it, is about how we handle times of upheaval and whether we embrace new things or our old comfort food favorites. And one of the really cool things that came out of that research was the idea that times of upheaval can actually be really powerful, positive times for consumers when the threads of their everyday habitual life are like untied and they have this opportunity to do new things. And so the new things can be, starting new bad habits, but they can also be starting new good habits. So, in this time when we've all had some really forced self-examination of our consumption habits, it's a really great opportunity to say, what are the new habits that I'd like to start? And to know that you've actually got a better cognitive likelihood of doing them now.
Well, in fact, we got a call from Kathleen Hall with a recommendation for just such a new idea, perhaps new in its intensity.
I had a great idea for parents that are getting a little tired of being inside. I know a lot of parents do not have backyards or even front yards, but for those that do, why not build a little family vegetable garden? I found my grandchildren love to watch the seeds grow. And because they've watched this plant produce, they eat everything from the vegetable garden raw. Okra, green beans, carrots, radishes. They don't care about the dirt because they know I don't spray poison. So I think it'd be a great idea and get those picky eaters, children that are picky eaters, to eat healthy. Spinach, too. Spinach comes up real fast. So does lettuce. Okay. Happy quarantining.
Kathleen Hall from Rougemont giving us tips. By the way, you can tell us your questions. Give us your questions or stories about the quarantine. For the number to text or call is 919-980-5414. 1-9. So this gets to some of what you're saying, Stacey, is that we start, you know, thinking about new strategies, new ways that we can adapt.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Victory Gardens from World War II, right? And when a lot of people discovered a love of gardening in a time when they had to do it. So looking for the positive here, I think, is going to be good for all consumers.
But
I was struck by Natalie's comments about the importance of high-touch surfaces in stores. In consumer behavior, we actually have a personality difference scale called need for touch. So people actually differ in how much they need to touch things while they're shopping. It's very interesting, and I can imagine that that's really going to play out in the future, whether you have people for whom it's very easy to keep their hands locked on their shopping cart and look with their eyes, and other people who are really going to have a hard time keeping their hands to themselves while they shop.
Well, Natalie, this does take us back to those questions about our general mistrust that has been expressed and that we've read. And I think part of this is just by the way the origins of this pandemic. Maybe you can give us a sense for why food may come in for tighter scrutiny in this particular case.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, and Stacey, chime in from your perspective too, but a lot of it is people are scared. And when you're scared, you want to figure out whether or not the normal things in life are still safe. We are looking at the epidemiology of this outbreak, and it was originally communicated that it was tied to an open air fish market, or live animal market. And so I have seen some misunderstanding potentially around that of, oh, well, if it was tied to a food market, then it has to be foodborne. If we go to any sort of place where food is sold on a busy day, there's just a lot of people. There are a lot of people really close to each other, a lot of people, touching the same surface. Maybe everyone was touching the same ATM. We don't know. But this mistrust of food, I think, potentially could also be because now we are under a state of emergency. And at least in North Carolina, most of the time when we see a state of emergency, we're seeing it for weather-related. And that weather-related usually does have an impact on the supply or the safety of food. So I think there are potentially a lot of different areas around it. And there's always the question of, is this going to be something unsafe for what I eat? But we just don't have any evidence there that it's going to be transmitted through food. It's the being near other people, and it's the touching those high-touch surfaces.
And that anxiety is translating in some cases to behavior within the store, not all cases, mm-hmm. but a Harris Teeter employee called to talk about her experience with some customers.
You have some that's really appreciative of us being here, but then you have some that come off very rude or they're in a rush because, you know, they want to get home. You know, some people are not considerate of your space when the rule says at Harris Teeter that supposed to have 6 feet for social distancing. Some of the customers don't even care about that. Like, they're in your face. They want to know why there's no stuff here. They want to know where's the truck. And it's like, as a front-end worker, I don't know the answer to that. And it's like, they don't care. They just want answers.
That's Althea, a Harris Teeter employee, talking about dealing with upset customers. If you're an essential worker in the food industry, you can tweet at us, tweet your stories at the hashtag CoronavirusNC. Stacey, do we tend to observe changes in consumer behavior only for the people most affected? Because there are certainly these folks on the front lines. What about the people who have to show up to work every day?
Yeah, I think the frontline workers are seeing the real diversity of responses to a new situation, to a crisis. And like we talked about before, you get that diversity across approach avoidance. But we also have to remember that there's differences, too, in whether scarcity is perceived, but really not that bad, and people who have real scarcity. So there are people who are simply feeling like there's not as much selection at the grocery store, and it may cause them to stock up on their normal snack food. But they've got the resources at home to, you know, weather the storm. But then there are other people, many of them who do still go out to work, who are experiencing real scarcity of money, rent money, food money. And so you're getting some kind of stress that comes simply from the perception. And then you've got people who are dealing with really true stress. And it is, you know, it's just a human fact that some people, they're better in those times and other people are crankier in those times.
We haven't talked about the producers yet, the people who are growing the food. And it's interesting because some of them are in very different situations depending on who their buyers are and how they're doing business. We heard from the owner of a farm stand in Robeson County. Let's hear what he had to say.
My name is Ellery Locklear, calling from Pembroke, North Carolina. I'm the owner of Locklear Farms. All my customers buy to eat at home. You know, I don't have any restaurants. So, I mean, the more people eat at home, I mean, I'm thinking my market's going to be better. I know a friend of mine, I mean, he's all wholesale. 50% goes straight to restaurants. 50% goes to, like, distributors. And, I mean, he's lost half his market because he's into higher-end restaurants that it's not, they can't do this takeout drive-through deal, you know. I'm sticking to what we would normally do if it was a normal year. We'd produce, I mean, we're planting constantly, weekly. So, I mean, I'm kind of still open if the market could be good for what I'm doing. So I may increase. So I'm leaving that as an option. I might plant even more than I would normally plant.
That's Ellery Locklear giving us an update from the front lines of his strawberry season down in Pembroke. Natalie, small farms especially sometimes depend on bringing people onto their property for events and to, you know, to buy at the store. What are you hearing from farmers, and are they concerned about their ability even to make a profit if they're doing direct sales like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we've had a lot of farmers, a lot of agricultural professionals reaching out, trying to figure out what they can do. And primarily the concern echoes of, we want to keep the people we serve safe. So some of this, like with you pick farms and stuff like that, if they're still choosing to stay open, the recommendations that we're making are to stagger entry, have people farther apart, you know, the cleaning and disinfecting of those high touch surfaces, not having a large gathering there are some who are becoming really creative in how they run farm stands and how they run farmers market. There's almost overnight dozens of farmers who have turned into online orders or order ahead or pre-order over the phone, stuff like that. So we're seeing a lot of creativity so that farmers can still do those direct-to-consumer sales and keep the public safe.
We've seen an example of that from actually a Southeast Asian market in Burke County that's using Facebook to let customers know what is in stock. Here's Chimin from Sinquan Marketplace.
It's kind of like, you know, when you call them to like a Staples food line or you go over a hardware store, you're calling and asking them if they have something in store. And they're like, they usually tell you if they don't or they do, and then, you know, the price. So with me communicating that on like the Facebook market, it's easier to show that if like one person asks or if I just post it, people will know that we have it. And they aren't having to worry about, we're just having to have like multiple people calling in. So like with them knowing what's going on with it, they're always updating. So if I'm updated with what's going on, I usually update the group. And then everybody within the group, if they're updated, they're, you know, share it to anybody or let friends or family know.
That's Chimin from Sinquan Marketplace in Burke County talking about how they managed panic buying. They ran out of supplies very quickly and then got their feet under them. Stacy, an interesting example of a business finding a creative way to serve customers. And I guess it really lets customers be strategic about their errands, too. Can you talk a bit about the business innovation in a time of crisis?
Yeah, I'd love to, because I think these are really smart and responsive things that the farmers and suppliers are doing. Crises are often great times for innovation. I think this one will be no different. In fact, a colleague and I at Wharton are starting a new project on how expectations impact innovation crisis innovation, because in essence, we have that mentality of, let's just try something. Whether it works, whether it doesn't work, we're okay with fast failure. Let's just try it. There's more value in, let's start an app, let's try this, let's try that. And there's less second guessing, less overthinking. People just do. And it sounds like these farmers and producers are doing just that. We see lots of students who are inventing new apps to help track the virus. We're seeing doctors who are inventing new ways to either clean or produce protective gear. it's actually quite an exciting time for human creativity.
Stacey, what do you think when this is all over? I think it's one of the ways that helps us sort of get past this is to try to think about when it's over. But also we're imagining consumer behavior. What do you think is going to last? What changes will kind of stay in place, do you think, and how much will revert?
Well, I think when things are immediately over, we might see kind of a rebound to do a lot of the things that we've been kept from. So throw some parties, buy things, go to movies, congregate in large groups. But it's going to go back to more normal. And yet, you know, you can never go home again, never step in the same river twice. We are going to be changed people, changed consumers. And one way that I've heard a lot of people talking about is actually the appreciation for being forced to do less. So I am wondering if there is going to be actually a little bit more careful consideration of the things that we choose to do with our time and our money after this is over. So will we sign up for quite as many activities? Will we have our kids doing quite as many sports? Or have we actually kind of enjoyed not racing around and having some family time?
Natalie, what do you think? Restaurants, grocery stores, farm stands, will they come back as normal? Are consumers going to demand more protection? What do you think?
I think it's a little early to tell with some of this stuff. Like what Stacey said, I think there will be an immediate, let's try and go back to normal. What has been encouraging and what has been interesting to watch is, you know, a lot of this infrastructure with takeout and delivery and stuff has already been in place. It just wasn't as widely used. So I think a lot of food businesses are realizing that they're capable of things that they might not have been in a rush to implement. So I'll be curious to see how many just different ways of buying, selling food that we have and how many of those last when they're not as imminently necessary.
Stacey, what do you foresee restaurants and grocery stores and other businesses for that matter doing to lure customers back as soon as possible?
In the beginning, I think it'll be sort of a festivity mindset, a celebration mindset. And so there might be events that are tied to that. But afterwards, I think they're going to have to be really mindful about the ways in which consumers have changed. And maybe they're going to have to think about ways in which they either are more mindful about food safety, how they package goods, how they arrange goods within the store, but also about what food means to people. So if people really got used to their family game nights, maybe that's something a restaurant has to consider in terms of rather than people having a now more enjoyable reason to eat at home, maybe they have to say, okay, come and bring your board game to our restaurant.
Stacey Wood, the Langdon Distinguished University Chair of Marketing at NC State's Poole College of Management. Stacey, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
And Natalie Seymour, a Food Safety Extension Associate with North Carolina State University. Natalie, thank you.
Thank you.